In yesterday afternoon's group session, my paper for this morning was eviscerated. You know, all the points in it were discussed in yesterday's group session. And this is simply another way of saying that we experience grief and go through forms of dying long before we ever hit the final one. When your member cuts his thumb off with a power mower in the backyard, or part of his foot, when your wife or a congregation member suffers a hysterectomy, when a child goes from home and goes to college, when a divorce occurs in a congregation or in the lives of people and families, these are very similar situations, and the dynamics, the contents of those situations are very, very similar to what we're talking about when we talk about this business of death. So what I'm trying to say is that I had a little premonitory experience of death last night when these guys just bowled through all my material. But anyhow, I'll read this more. Ministry in the Face of Death. We are in a period of transition. After thousands of years in which the fact of death was woven into the central chords of daily human existence, man in our time is experimenting with the possibility of rejecting the reality of death. The once powerful cognizance of his mortality is giving way to a secular approach to death which masks death's certainty and finality. This phenomenon is developing precisely at a time during which the incidence of death statistically is ever more constantly and abundantly around us. The whole human population is nervously aware of the daily possibility of massive nuclear destruction. The observation of death by automobile and aircraft accidents, to say nothing of massive expenditures of human life in wars, famines, and natural disasters, are part of the daily fare of our headlines, radio broadcasts, the film media, and telecasts. But our daily heavy dosage of death and dying, usually by violent means, somehow not only fails to deepen our insights and sharpen our perspectives with reference to its reality, but strangely reinforces our avoidance of it. Instead of incorporating his mortality into a total view of what he is and how he should live, instead of confronting his finitude with all resources of his religion, his hope, and the wonderment that are his heritage, modern man is working hard at dismissing death as an unfortunate incident, carrying little significant relationship to the content of his life. Medical and technological developments in recent years have pushed death back in time for most of us, and correspondingly postponed its challenge to the lifestyles to the lifestyles of many of us. Socially, the attention paid to the rites and cultural observances surrounding death is growing more and more impersonal. Religiously, both the anticipation of immortality as well as death's fear and mystery have been ignored or dispelled or lost, along with much of its meaning. Death is suffering eviction from the context of contemporary American life. Half a century ago, we were on more intimate terms with death. In fact, mortality and death in childbirth were commonplace, along with that occasioned by influenza, tuberculosis, appendicitis, and now other conquered maladies. In those days, the final moments of life were observed by the family. As I recall, as a boy, I was the one who carried my father up the stairs in our two-story house there to the bed that he never got out of. My brother carried him down into the living room. When my father died, my mother closed his eyes, I tied up his chin, and I helped fold his hands on his chest, you know, and arrange the bedclothes around him so he would look good, you know, or as good as he could look, when the relatives came after we got on the phone and told them that he had, to inform them that he had died. In those days, the final moments of life were observed by the family. The dying member was wheeled out of the bedroom and into the living room, where in state already, last words were exchanged
one by one, with members of the family. Wives, sons, and daughters closed the eyes of the deceased, bound up his chin, bathed the body, carried it to its funeral setting. The bells of the church were rung, friends visited, and everyone in that community sensed the meaning of this corporate enterprise personally, and made frequent application of that meaning to his own anticipated demise by way of each corporate, concrete, and each individual association with the dead and the bereaved that preceded it. Today, however, dying is done in the wings by the majority of the more than 5,000 Americans who die daily. The final moments are rarely observed by the family. Surrounded by aseptic equipment, by the hum, gurgle, and blip of sustaining and monitoring machines, by the barren white walls of the hospital, and with adequate medication to alleviate pain and discomfort, most patients today do not die, but simply fade away, and more tragically, they do it alone. They are efficiently then processed out of existence with the cool detachment, which is more and more coming to characterize modern life. With the family preferring to remain outside, the body quickly disappears to be handled by an undertaker. It reappears more often not in a church for the entire community, but in a funeral home for a small circle of friends and families. Attendance at burial is even smaller. All this adds up to the fact that the community has been separated from the dying and the dead. The dramatic changes in medical science and institutional care have contributed indirectly to our alienation from death. The training of personnel for hospital work and the vocational preparation of doctors is increasingly coming to include attention to the interior factors of patient progress, and we logically would expect a degree of immunity from the syndrome of death avoidance on the part of the medical community, therefore. After all, this structure of society today deals with the dying repeatedly, consistently, and as part of its professional responsibility. However, doctors, nurses, and hospital administrators are, after all, human too. And their proximity to death, as well as their ongoing exposure to it, is no guarantee of the cultivation of expertise in and sensitivity to the work of dying when it appears in specific human situations. All kinds of obstructions arise, and I'm thinking about the medical community now. Researchers Glaser and Strauss, reporting their findings on closed awareness systems in American hospitals, cited the following five structured conditions, atmospheres that are built into the systems, the organization of hospitals, which contribute to a conspiracy of silence under which many patients go about their dying. First of all, most patients are not especially experienced at recognizing the signs of impending death. Their rehearsals for dying, that is, the observation of death in others, have been too few. Secondly, American physicians, ordinarily do not tell patients outright that death is probable or inevitable. This is based on the physician's conviction that announcement of terminality to a person is likely to precipitate forms of trauma which will complicate the patient's condition further and perhaps even kill him. And in league with this conviction is the additional tenet of professional ideology, namely the belief that patients really do not wish to know whether or not they are dying. Now, presumably some of them do not wish to know their fates, and there is no really good evidence, but there is no really good evidence that all of them wish to remain in ignorance. On the contrary, findings have shown that there is some good evidence that many of them do want to know. But like other Americans, physicians quite possibly shy away from the embarrassment and the difficulty of this kind of disclosure and tend to avoid the scene that announcement of impending death may precipitate in the patient. A third structural condition is that families also tend to guard the secret. While they usually will confirm what the physician has already announced, the initiating of disclosure by the family or by a family member seems rare. A fourth structural condition cited by Glaser and Strauss is related both to the organization of hospitals and to the commitments of personnel who work within them. Hospitals, whether by intention or accident, and we're not worried about that, are arranged and operated in ways which contribute to the hiding of medical information from the patient. Records, the knowledge of personnel over and against the patient's condition, staff talk, which can escalate to a kind of rarefied vocabulary, which talks the truth in its own terms, but always with the intention of maintaining another language to prevent the truth from coming to the patient. And also the collusive behavior of medical personnel in the patient's presence subtly maintain distance between the patient's impression of his condition and the real facts about it. Fifthly, and somewhat less apparent, is the fact that the patient has no allies to reveal or help him discover the staff's knowledge of his impending death. Not only his family, but also other patients withhold that information if they know. What would seem to be necessary or called for in such a system of interlocking conditions is the element of trust. A change in any one of those five conditions would convert this closed awareness system into an open one. Trust must be part of the history of a particular relationship, or else it must be earned, not learned. Hence, in a system in which avoidance of death seems to receive such heavy priority, the chances for its development are slim. So the medical profession also contributes to the weaving of the fabric of contemporary death denial. Mourning has been one of the traditional rites of passage through which families rid themselves of their dead and return to normal life. There used to be groupings of family members hushed in reverence or noisy with their wailings, wakes and fixed periods of grieving, friends from the community beyond the immediate family who ministered with food and service to the stricken family, which was considered to be in no condition to care for its practical affairs. And while the family focused its attention on a sustained contemplation of the reality of the passage of their loved one, there was the simultaneous signal raised by the involvement of members in the community that their presence, that is, the members of the community, was a reassurance of the continuing place and the responsibility of the survivors within the life of that community. Now, this is important if you consider the triple process that's involved in grief work. It's a way of signaling to the bereaved, yes, we welcome you back, while the bereaved are searching for ways back into the community after the loss and the separation of death. By no means does anyone who think about these things hold the opinion that the age of such demanding observances be recalled. I'm not by this paper saying that we ought to do have Irish wakes and Negro parade processionals with as they once did in New Orleans and in the East. Funerals then were as culturally conditioned as they are now, and I think that we have to find new ways of expressing our grief under the terms of new conditions in a new age. The fact, however, remains that in much of society today, the common avoidance of conversation about and the repression of what used to be the natural cognizance of death place in the midst of life has resulted in the separation of many a bereaved person from the group, the community, which at that time he so desperately needs. The funeral and mortuary industry today, however, has cooperated with the widespread and growing game of social repression of true grief. There is little informality, spontaneity, or variety of individual expression in the funerals of America today. Standardization of funeral procedure, the demythologization of the wake, a growing use of funeral parlors instead of churches, and the decrease in the number of the funerals ritual participants all correspond to the pattern of denial. And in a number of instances, when asked about the type of accusations and questionable practices leveled against the industry, as those alleged in Jessica Mitford's American Way of Death, funeral and mortuary executives have simply shrugged and replied, "We just give people what they want." And that is true. Like the going American myth, which maintains that people over 40 are no longer potential people, there is an implicit popular opinion that has already adjudged death to be unsanitary, degrading to the bereaved, and somehow obscene. Last, but by no means least, in the total pattern of avoidance and death and denial of death is the clergyman. The minister or rabbi visits the dying and his family. He helps with the arrangements. He officiates at funeral and burial services and follows up to one extent or another with post-burial calls upon the bereaved. He's ready, to the degree of his ability, to meet and deal with any problems raised within the context of the family's grief. His purpose is to function as witness to God's love for his people in Christ as they pass through the valley of the shadow of death. But the pastor is human too. He too, a skilled practitioner with the many familiar instruments of his craft, is susceptible to the temptation to pick up any one of those instruments and to use it self-protectively. Indeed, the same stature generally accorded him by society as religious servant and leader can be, quote, fulfilled by him in death and bereavement situations by a stance of set-apartness, to be in the situation and yet not of it, by a self-preserving objectivity similar to the clinical distance of language and or behavior which a doctor or a nurse may adopt in the presence of or in conversation with a dying patient. This insularity may take varied forms. Frustrated by the patient's inability to communicate, unsure of the amount of freight his relationship with the dying or the bereaved will bear, or perhaps even at a loss for what to say while driven by the need to say something, the clergyman may easily slip into the ritualized actions in which he feels familiar and secure. That's a denial of the growth process. It's a denial of dying on the part of the clergyman, which I think meets the outline of George Benson's analogy of growth. Thus, hearing confessions, reading scripture, saying prayers, and even administering the sacrament may come to constitute components of his defense syndrome. Subtle reinforcement for this may also be there, as perhaps at other times, in the forms of special language, special attire, and an on-the-spot busyness born of a self-consciousness about having nothing to do in his visits to the death chambers of his people. His words to the family about death, the will of God, and life hereafter, while never, and I mean that, never to be scorned under any circumstances, even when they're the ritualized and self-conscious production of a man who's not secure in a situation such as that, while never to be scorned under any circumstances, may border, however, in his own judgment, in these occasions, on being meaningless cliché. Of course, the problem with that is that it robs the situation of his ministration at that point. It robs it of a lot of color and of a lot of authenticity. In my personal history in the ministry, I was frequently troubled by my abbreviated attention to the plight of families in grief. But the funeral always came as an intrusion into an already crowded schedule. The visit to the funeral home was usually sandwiched between other essential calls and or meetings, and the prospective task of shaping up an adequate sermon within a day and a half seemed gargantuan, demanding a block of time that was sure to invade the sleep hours. The result of all this was frequently the inner preconscious conviction that I was faring more badly than the bereaved, and went about my duties like a suffering martyr. While this may say nothing about the denial of death, it is nevertheless an attendant vocational difficulty which tends to fix and perpetuate our own evaluations of what we're up to in our callings at a level which prevents our vocational vision from penetrating through to the basic points of our complicity in the denial syndrome. Perhaps more important in this vein, however, is our victimization by or our easy submission to the tyranny of time. Deaths among our people are almost always interruptions for us as pastors. Life goes on, we say, and indeed it does, but in its wake, and also frequently in ours, are those who are left after the benediction at the gravesite to work through their grief alone. We need to get back on the track after the funeral. In my conversations with pastors on what they felt to be their biggest failing in the handling of the dying and the bereaved, their regrets most frequently centered on the post-funeral ministry to the bereaved. And I must confess that in my ministry in this general area, that this was my greatest failing also. For pastors are human too. Like other men, they become to one degree or another reflectors of their age and participate in its dynamics. And while we are called to be in this world and to know it and to even work with some of its dynamics, we need constantly to maintain that alien and alienating integrity of vocation which keeps us proclaiming the gospel to the real issues that are present in the lives of people. The pastor, alive and sensitive to those real issues as they are found in a death-denying society, can do much to help both his people and others of this age to face death rather than to flee from it. And now I'd like to gear in on the pastor. After all this, part two. In many instances,
the parent beholds a ready-made position of trust and credibility, both among his members of the community in general and specifically among his own members. Especially within the contexts of congregational and other group church group situations, the history of his sharing in the life experiences of people, and especially, I think, people in crisis and other troubles, results in a host of relationships over a period of time in which his people readily confide in him and are susceptible to his guidance and direction. That position over and against people eminently equips him for helping them to meet and accept death, both their own and the deaths of their loved ones, in a mature and healthy way. But it soon becomes apparent to one of us, to one who is in touch with himself, and who is therefore aware of the sources of his attitudes and actions, it soon becomes apparent that his own rationale and attitudinal system over and against his own mortality must be mature and whole, or as much as these can be, before he himself is capable of effecting a helpful ministry among the dying and the bereaved. As the literature on death and dying so frequently reminds us, each man must come to terms with his own mortality. And at this point, I must confess that I am to some degree shooting in the dark. I am not secure in knowing exactly what that phrase, to come to terms with one's own mortality, actually means. Furthermore, the standardization of approach and handling of whatever it is which I see or seem to see in the literature is made more difficult for me to buy outright by virtue of the fact that I know that each man, each a different person, each one must die his own death. I'm thinking of the preparation of the pastor for the work of ministry to the dying here. And what we're talking about really is what they always say, you've got to come to terms with your own death. It's got to be done in life. Consequently, the remarks which follow will constitute my own impression of what that phrase means to me. Certain of these points are still on the way due to my own sporadic and intermittent opportunities for reflection on. But of this I am sure, lest his own fears, denial, and superficiality risk the endorsement of those dynamics in the dying and the bereaved, it behooves the Christian pastor, in one way or another, to work through his own appraisal of the reality of his death. The following points, I think, are worth considering in this respect. And this is tentative offering that to come to terms with one's mortality means. First, that we recognize that in each of us there exists the belief that we will never die. That's the Freudian denial of mortality business. And I'm not really 100% on that either. But number two, that we acknowledge the tension established over and against that belief, number one, by its observable antithesis, namely that all living things do die, and to practice a conscious, occasional consideration of that fact. Thirdly, that we let things have their proper place. That is, to grow in our conviction that things are the good, temporary, useful, and enjoyable possessions of God, that they are ours in a derivative sense only, and that we therefore bear responsibility for their handling. And I really didn't say this well, but what I'm trying to say is that the whole created order of things outside of me, and therefore I'd like to include people in this, when I say thing, not that I reduce people to things, but that people are also included in the idea of things in item number three. Fourthly, that we be open, susceptible, and submissive, if you will, to the testimony and outward evidences of those articles of our faith which equip us for hope amid the discovered realities of whatever aversions and fears the contemplation of our death might uniquely raise within us. And those articles of our faith, which I think are important. Now, obviously, they're not all of them, but in this context, the ones that I think are important are that God indeed loves his world, this world, and all of us in it, that the created order of things richly attests to his glory, and that its beauty and wonder are gifts and signs to us, of this to us. Secondly, that his death moved him to intervene into our condition of progressing decline and death due to sin, in the sending of his Son. And through that Son, he initiated a new age. Thirdly, that his death was for and in place of my own, to which I was once condemned by the law, but now I am released into new life. The sting of death is removed, and so forth. Next, that his resurrection marked the end of the tyranny of the last enemy, corralled him into our service, and thus transformed death into our friend. And finally, in this little grouping, that life, much more than mere survival, waits for me on the other side of my dying. And I don't use the word death for a reason there. Fifthly, that we realize that the only thing of ourselves that will truly survive our death is the life that we pass on in the form of the love that we spend into the mainstream of humanity. And that the life of the gospel wrapped up in the gift of our service and communicated to men is enough to have lived for. That is to say, part of our belief orientations as servants of God through people ought to be our ability to affirm with the psalmist, "Thy grace is better than life." And finally, and this is coming up to the surface of day-by-day life, and finally, that these factors become the substantive moving principles of our beings, that they become part of the fabric of our persons, and thus more than the merely intellectual apprehended requirements of our vocations. A second factor which looms large as potentially helpful to the pastor's personal death and dying orientations is his vicarious experience with the dying and bereaved. Many pastors are privileged to be in association with the dying and bereaved, if not constantly, then at least intermittently throughout any given year of their ministry. This kind of exposure can play a primary role in shaping the pastor's personal self-sufficiency with respect to the death in his life. It can also be the material for his growing effectiveness in ministering to the dying and bereaved. The report by Dr. Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, as well as others, indicate personal growth of the counselor as the chief result of experiences in connection with ministry to the dying. But as is often pointed out, such value only comes to those who reflect upon both the individual and long-term content of their contacts with the dying and bereaved, and who thereby begin to bring to the level of conscious awareness the meaning that is inherent in those shared experiences for their application to future situations. Hence, assuming the pastoral predispositions of openness, sensitivity, and the readiness to take the communications of the dying and the bereaved seriously and in love, the normal continuum of such cases in his pastoral work provides the pastor with a prime context in which to learn and to grow. Such experiences in time are bound to affect some change in the pastor's orientations, and the content of each of those experiences reflected upon and evaluated will also heighten his effectiveness in subsequent similar ones. But there is another set of phrases which occurs with some regularity in the literature on this subject, and that system of references may be summed up in the words, "As a man has lived, so shall he die." I think this is the kernel of the whole business. What this means is that the central dynamics which control a man's living throughout all the years of his life will be manifest in the grief associated with his dying. For example, and here I'm speaking roughly and in general, I'm not a psychological type, and I cannot really dredge out one, two, three, all the examples that I'd like to be able to, that I have read with respect to this equality between the fundamental dynamics of a man's living and those things which are, if not manifest and obvious, always moving around in the dynamics of the dying person. What this means is that the central dynamics which control a man's living throughout all the years of his life will be manifest in the grief associated with his dying. For example, and in general, a life that is characterized by a joyful acceptance of the new, a life geared to the unanxious readiness to receive and move through change and surprise, that kind of life, generally speaking, can be expected to accept death in basically the same way. If a man is geared to live this way, the chances are he will also die that way. On the other hand, the life that depends upon fixed patterns, positions, and opinions, where the personality is fearful and at its roots in need of the stable, the familiar, and the secure, that life may well close with considerable difficulty, because the questions of death's unknowns, its dissolution of the body, and the separation factor from familiar persons, places, and things, will become frightfully important as death draws near. While these examples, and any other for that matter in this thing, can in no wise be adopted as clean, predictable expressions of it, the principle seems to be generally true. As a man has lived, so shall he die. The implication for us as pastors is that we recognize through this principle that the style and inner realities of our members' dyings will be directly related to the style and inner realities of their living. Ed Schrader had something to say about this in his use of the term the feedback potential of death, reflecting back upon the meaning that the life had, if I understand him correctly on that. The gospel we preach and teach is, in our opinion, the one essential life-changing, life-shaping instrument of our ministries. Furthermore, since so much of the shaping of basic attitudes begins in early childhood, Christian education takes on impressive importance. A basic honesty within the Christian community between pastor and people and among people becomes an essential part of that community's culture. Preaching must have its roots in the realities which drive, support, or control the living of people. And if this is going to be possible, close personal relationships will need to be developed between pastor and people in order for him to discover where and what those realities and dynamics actually are. And hopefully along the way, we will grow in our care for one another in that kind of a context. But primary to this kind of operation, I believe, is the pastor's primary frontal visual aid potential. Before all else, he needs to be the one who has come through his own crisis. He must have, if he is to teach others, come to terms with his own mortality. And if the principle, as a man has lived, so shall he die, is true, then I think his personal and vocational life will bear an ever-deepening knowledge and an ever-multiplying application of the gospel of Jesus Christ. But what about the broader dimensions of death and dying as it manifests itself in this society? Are there ways in which the church, and specifically its clergy, can help with the rehumanization of the dying process for the thousands who experience it every day? In recent years, the concept of a helping team approach to institutionalized patients has merged as a means toward ministering to the person's total needs. This model functions with the cooperative efforts of doctor, minister, social worker, social caseworker, psychiatrist, etc. I do not think it would be beyond possibility in many instances for a pastor to suggest to hospital administrators and or other responsible staff personnel that opportunities for discussion of the problems of the dying be somehow provided in the program of continuing education in local medical institutions. I was a pastor in one of the southern states, in the southern district of this country, and in one instance, it became quite apparent to me, simply by virtue of my exposure and visits to hospitals, that the vocational level and the vocational grip of that hospital was somewhere down in the cellar. I was in situations where I would be praying with a couple, and the young man who had just been brought in from an automobile accident, the son of this couple, where the intern and the doctor who received this kid in the emergency ward, watching us pray, would snicker and laugh. That's one thing. On another instance, there seemed to be a mass exodus of the personnel out of this hospital's medical staff into the areas of public medicine. And just by chance, within this whole two-month period, I got together with some people under varying circumstances who said to me that I'm sick of touching people. I'm sick of dealing with their bodies and their persons. I want a job, and I'm qualified for it. Why shouldn't I grab it? And the pay is much higher. I want a job in public medicine. And one of the men from my congregation, who happened to be a urologist in that congregation, in that hospital, simply came to me and told me that. I said, yeah, I've been hearing about that sort of thing, or getting signals about that sort of thing, too. And he said to me, what do you think can be done about that? And it just so happened that the staff and administrative personnel of that hospital had monthly meetings, discussion, where they talked about their problems. And not at my under my pressuring, and not by virtue even of my getting the idea, but by virtue of his suggestion to me as a Christian layman. For the next 3 or 4 months, we had little 20-minute sessions in the staff and administrative meetings of the hospital in which we discussed this problem of what it means to be vocationally dedicated as a doctor. You know, well, that's the sort of thing that I'm suggesting here. The same type of approach may be possible in nursing homes, retirement villages, and geriatric institutions as a means of both lessening the anxieties of people who care for the terminally ill and therefore also enabling them to provide more meaningful services to such patients. More parochially, it would seem to me that a circuit of pastors, and I think this would be fun, working together in a program of study and interpersonal sharing, perhaps with the representatives of the medical and psychological disciplines, could in time come to be significant leavening influence in terms of the interest and attention that this subject got in their given locale, to say nothing of the personal accrual to a person's readiness for the handling of death and grief situations. A third possibility for working toward healthier American attitudes and treatment of the fact of death might be to suggest and engage in conversations with local or regional morticians and funeral directors with a view of promoting communication and understanding across vocational lines, which will eventually contribute to the psychological and other welfare of the dying and the bereaved. In many instances, the funeral director simply does not understand what we are about and why in our public and private services to the bereaved. In others, his range of experience with people in the crisis of grief may well serve to sharpen our own insights and understanding. It's at this point, as I so well remember, that we think of our crowded schedules, our imminent and as yet unmet responsibilities, our obligations of correspondence, circuits, districts, and so forth. We think of our bare-bones roles as husbands and fathers and so forth. It's at this point that we usually heave a great mental sigh and ask, who is sufficient for these things? And that leads us to the third crisis, I think, in our whole approach to this business. I think it's not so much a crisis anymore, the role of the laity. The 16th chapter of Howard Kleinbell's Basic Types of Pastoral Counseling is entitled The Layman's Ministry of Pastoral Care and Counseling. For me to quote, what is the clergyman's function? He is, by his training and ordination, equipped and designated to function as a leader and a specialist in that which is the work of every Christian. Instead of being a one-man band who plays each Sunday for a passive congregation, he should be the conductor of an orchestra who helps each person make his unique contribution to the symphony of the good news. His key role is described in Ephesians to equip God's people for work in his service. His job is to train, inspire, guide, and coach, and work alongside the lay ministers as a teacher of teachers, a pastor of pastors, and counselor of counselors. It seems we may be coming out of the woods. By a providence that can only be ascribed to God's Spirit, the slow realization by the church of the meaning and necessity of an operative priesthood of believers is beginning to take concrete shape. An ever-increasing number of laymen, aware of themselves as in ministry to church and world in their everyday life, has come to provide the Christian enterprise with a resource of vitality and potential that has long lain dormant. Already the role of laymen in functions as formerly diverse as preaching and the staffing of daycare centers, or of social and community organizers and church business managers, has become a part of history. Along with such involvements on the part of Christians, a broadening of vision with respect to the meaning of ministry and the availability of opportunities for it has exposed many laymen to situations which have contributed to the growth of their self-consciousness as the people of God and as members of a caring community. Hence, with respect to the topic at hand, it would seem that a pastor could in time develop from out of his membership a select core of people who also in time could be trained to complement his efforts in behalf of the dying and the bereaved. In time also, I am sure the climate of care characterizing those who bear one another's burdens would grow and spread among his people, moving with that same reflexive action of growth and profit for those who minister and those who minister to. One should probably start with education, utilizing the existing structures of study groups, adult Bible classes, and so forth. The pastor and his group may wish to simply study the subjects of death, dying, sickness, and bereavement, with adequate attention being given to both theological as well as practical dimensions. Within or outside such ongoing programs, he may feel it would be valuable to conduct a tour of institutions in which his people have opportunity to observe on a first-hand basis something of the plight of people who face death in their community. Just as the alcoholic members of the congregation who are on the wagon are one of the church's primary resources for working with other alcoholics in the congregation and community, and just as those members who have experienced sickness, hospitalization, surgery, and convalescence, to say nothing of things like divorce, family breakdown, tensions within the family, are in many instances the most well-equipped persons to deal in a ministering way with people in similar circumstances of illness, so do those members who healthily survived the loss of a close relative and its grief have a calling, by virtue of their unique experience, to serve those who walk through that same valley. Given a level of trust and shared spirit of loving helpfulness, the same group methods which ventilate feelings and which clarify and objectify the problems of non-communication, divorce, family, and other common problems of our time can also be employed among our congregation's aged and bereaved. By virtue of the fact that representatives of other professions are also concerned about the problems of death and dying, we can assume that virtually any community will have resource persons who will be willing to share their insights and understanding. The pastor himself will thus welcome the input of the lawyer, the medical doctor, hospital administrator, psychologist, funeral director, and so forth, as a vital adjunct to such a group's progress. But the important thing to remember when the planning, the recruiting, the staffing, and the processing of such a group are at an end is that the members of that group are now heavies in their area. They can now begin to move in what might be called a pastoral way among others in the throes of bereavement or in the dynamics which accompany coming to terms with impending death. We're almost finished now, I guess. Another effective method of meeting the needs of the bereaved and the dying is to begin to take our elders seriously. Along with their function as advisor to the pastor in liturgical and administrative affairs, the elders of a congregation could be assigned groups of families which could become the objects of their spiritual care. Their role in the confirmation process and stewardship and Christian education efforts, etc., and as carers for their assigned families could be extended after preparation to include ministry to the sick and dying, and especially to the bereaved. Such ministry might include gathering a bereaved family together for a few moments of simple, quiet worship on the Sunday evening after the funeral. It may be that some child's Sunday school teacher may be the best one to interpret the death of a child to his or her brother or sister, or parent, for that matter. Fellowship and women's guilds will, of course, always be available to inconspicuously go about caring for the physical needs of the bereaved. And of course, in funeral and burial services, friends of the deceased are always preferable to, quote, hired hands, unquote. But to go on listing organizational styles, illustrations of ideas that have worked, and methods of approach that seems to me to be somewhat superfluous. The best programs, if you want to use that term, that emerge to meet the given needs and opportunity for ministry in local situations are always those which are discovered, analyzed, and responded to out of the imagination, creative effort, and cooperative strategizing of pastors and people who live in the freedom of that kind of life in which service comes first and in the light of which historical divisions and status are of negligible importance. In summary, then, the burden of this presentation is that we recognize a trend toward the secularization of death in our time and that we become aware of its repression in the personal, social, and institutional quarters of our life. A second concern was to indicate the need for pastors who, by beginning with insights into the meanings of their own death, will be able to foster and promote a renewed framework of attitude toward death, and thereby to the dying, which will be consistent with faith and helpful to the dying and the bereaved. Thirdly, in a time in which pastoral duties and claims upon time have multiplied, it suggests that for overall progress in reinforming contemporary concepts and behavior in the church and in society in general today, the role of the laity in service is essential. Suffice it to say that the means by which this paper sees solution to both the macrocosmic and microcosmic problems imposed by a pervading contemporary myth, namely that death in one way or another is not, or that it is something else than what it is, or that it is the end of hope, is the same old means by which God seeks to extend his peace to all men, that is, through the people who have been surrounded by his peace and who, in its splendor, could not help but share it with others.
On page 6, point 5, I didn't understand.
Let me get one.
I kind of thought this section would draw some fire. Point number 5? Did you say point number 5 on page 6?
Point 5.
Oh. Right, what I'm trying to say there is this, that it's true. That what survives of me will not be the gold chain, the memory of my having lived in the minds of other people. My grandchildren will never know what I looked like. Probably. It won't be any kind of monument, material monument, either of my production or of anyone else's. In time, everything that surrounded me that testified to the fact that I had lived once will be gone, gone, gone. The only thing that survives of me is that which is unable to be identified with me. And that's the love that should be inspired in me by virtue of my Christian stance into the lives of my children, which shapes their lives in such a way that they get more life in their lifetimes, and which is thereby passed on to their children, who, because they had more life, their children get more life, etc. It's that kind of thing that I'm talking about when I say that we ought to pass on through the wrenching expenditures of love, the dying that George was talking about yesterday, through the wrenching expenditures of love, that we pass on that part of ourselves into the mainstream of humanity. And that means that an incarnation has happened, really, because it's under the terms of this packaged gospel wrapped up in the life of the individual that happens.
Well, Mr. Chairman, the reason I ask this is I can make a case out here that you're denying the resurrection. You've just said up here, you've talked about the resurrection of Christ and that our life, which is more than mere survival, awaits us. You've just said that. Now, if somebody just ripped this paragraph out of here, it would look pretty queer. Yeah. Would you say the only thing that truly survives on earth?
Yeah, that's a good way to do it. Good, yeah.
All right.
Yeah, I'll do it.
Right.
Just to move into this a little, even perhaps on this basis of passing on this life by service, etc. And here's a real sticker, I think, for all of us in the field. Perhaps you should ask what is being done in the field. And I'm speaking of whom do we bury if a man is definitely an unbeliever? And as far as we can judge, nevertheless, you feel that you want to render a service to the family. How do you, in integrity, go ahead and handle this situation in passing on this life?
I don't want to start a fight or a big discussion on this, because I think it's a corporate decision that's arrived at within a congregation's leadership, between a congregation's leadership and its pastor. I had the great, great, great good fortune of having been in congregations in which, from the beginning, I sat down with my elders and I said to them, I want to be on the list of every funeral director in this town. I want to scoop up and grab hold of every funeral that I can do. Whether or not I know the person is not of primary importance to me, although it would be good if I did. But even in cases when someone has no clergyman, I want to be first on your list, you know, the list of the funeral directors. And I realize this is contrary to the
sensitivities and to the tradition of many congregations. However, it's based on the conviction that there is no time at which, you know, in the given the cultural, and I'm not talking about the faith, I'm talking about the secular society today, there is no time in which the trauma, I think, and the needs of people are greater than in funeral. And I hate to see people assigned a chaplain who does nothing more than read the scriptures, say a prayer, and dump somebody into the ground. I want to know who the bereaved are. I feel that a ministry, in terms of funerals, is a ministry, everybody knows that cliche, is a ministry primarily to the living. And I'm interested in them. And if I sin in this area, I would rather sin in the area of doing too much than in the area of not doing enough.
There are two customs today. One is that people will their bodies to science, and I know some who don't even have any kind of a funeral then. Sometimes they have funerals, sometimes they don't, but some do not. And very closely related to this, then, of course, is the fact that the funeral director and the immediate family take care of the burial, and a memorial service is held at some, usually the quotes are, more convenient time. Like your comments on these two things.
Right. Well, I think it's important for Christians, or for anyone for that matter, I think it's important for them to make sure that when they will their eyes or their organs to charitable and scientific institutions, that they make sure that what's left is returned. I feel strongly about that simply because of the fact that I think that you need the presence of a body to facilitate the grief work in the bereaved family. I don't think it's a little difficult. You can do it with an urn, too, I suppose, or you can do it with a little package, depending upon what the practice of that particular institution is in sending back what's left over after the organs have been harvested. But the idea is that I think it's preferable. I don't think it's completely inviolably necessary, but I think it's preferable that people have the remains, or the remains of the remains, after such a donation has occurred. I think, and they ought to have a funeral too. That's what I think. The second thing you mentioned was the fact that it's sort of soft-pedaled, the whole ritual of the funeral. I don't think it should be. I'm just sorry that we don't have more, all of our funerals in church. You know, every time it's a terrific visual aid. And people, I think, learn more in one significant visual instance than they do in 1,600 verbal ones. You know.
Sir? Bob, I think you've touched on many things that all of us, as pastors, have been thinking about a great deal in recent years, especially. And in a pastoral conference or circuit conference not too long ago, we discussed the possibility of upon the death, the family requesting that burial proceed immediately. That is, if I would pass away today, that tomorrow morning my family would be at the cemetery there for a burial service, maybe a few representatives of the congregation, and then tomorrow evening or maybe Sunday or some other time in the next few days, that there be a service of rejoicing and thanksgiving, a service of victory and triumph in the congregation and for any of those whose lives I may have touched during my ministry. And as we discussed this, some of us felt very strongly that this would be a trend which we should encourage and try to establish, that we make so much of this hovering over the corpse. You know, it's in our area of the country, often the corpse is in the funeral home for 2 or 3 days, and there are seldom such hilarious gatherings as there are in the funeral homes, and the family is put through such torture through all of this, and we feel, or some felt, it would be a real Christian witness to dispose of the body as soon as possible and then have this service of victory. Some of the pastors felt this is a way to go. Others felt that we owe it to our congregations to conform to the practices of the community in which we are living, to let the people, that the pastor does not belong to his family at all, that he is belongs to the congregation, and we owe it to the congregation to go through all of the formalities that the community is, usually goes through. Would you care to express yourself on that at all?
Yeah. Okay, I'm trying to, there were about two or three things. In the first place, let me say this. The purpose of the funeral, and of course anybody can make their own description, but it seems, but it seems traditionally, historically, going way back to the time of the Jews, you know, the Old Testament, Israelite, the purpose of the funeral, really, is twofold, and I think it can be applied to our time, too. First of all, it's to bear witness to the Christian conviction with respect to death, and to do it publicly. Secondly, and equally important, if you're thinking that it's primarily for the bereaved, secondly, the work of the funeral is to begin or to facilitate the grief process. Where you, for instance, operate with a system, and like everything else in this world, nothing is 100%. Whatever you do, you're going to be like 10% wrong, you know? You know, on this side or the other side. Everything's got its built-in ambiguity and nothing is perfect. And consequently, what you're talking about emphasizes the proclamatory, the Christian stance and belief and conviction aspect while it sandwiches in. When you say, for instance, we want to eliminate the business of crying over the corpse and everything like this, I say, I understand what you want to do, and yet when you compress that time so drastically, you also take away from yourself a period of time which is useful in the facilitation of and the working with people in their grief. You understand what I mean? These two factors, and they're always in tension with one another. The Christian witness that the funeral is, and on the other hand, the work that you're doing through the Christian funeral to get the grief process in motion here and help people work through it. So I can't say. I would not, however, let's say, simply on the basis of what's going in the culture, even the ecclesiastical culture, I would not draw my necessities from what those signals. I would tend more to individualize. For instance, I had a kid, a five-year-old boy who died, and we, not my own, in our congregation, and we worked out a complete service. We worked out a complete post-funereal memorial system structure, and not only for that boy, but also for other people who died in the congregation, and did it every year, that sort of thing. Not because of the fact that this was done someplace else, but in sensing and in sinking ourselves both vicariously into the dynamics of that situation, we felt these are the things that we got to do. You understand? And while we utilized portions of the Christian burial and all that, and memorial service, out of the agenda and everything, we utilized that stuff to give the sense of continuity and a feeling of yesness to the whole thing historically in the minds of people, we didn't do structurally what was, you know, outlined in our normal procedural agenda materials. I hope I haven't confused the answer by making it so long, you know, but what I'm trying to say is that those two poles of the funeral thing are always there, and each of them have to be given careful consideration all the time. What you do ritually and what within that ritual doing helps people. Does it help them? You know? And when you ask that question, then you say, I got to know something about the dynamics of grief and the processes of grief. And that means there's got to be a balance.
Well, I personally feel that where there is a strong Christian conviction, where the pastor has, you know, throughout his ministry, been expressing the joy, the victory, the triumph of death, that perhaps the best way for a pastor's family then to express this is to dispense with this burial in a big hurry, but to make it a real time of triumph and victory. Death is the Christian's triumphant hour. And if we believe this, and if we have taught this to our people, and if in this replay we talked about so much yesterday and you alluded to again this morning, if our whole life we are seeing every crisis, every reverse and the like as a little death, you know, preparing for us for our final death, yeah. It would seem to me that it seems so pagan about the funerals that we have in our own country. Right. Overseas, as you know, they immediately, they don't bother with embalming or anything. They have their caskets sitting in their homes for years before their death. Some people even sleep in those caskets for a couple years before they put them in the ground. And then sprinkle a little lime in the bottom of the thing and put the lid on, and two or three hours after the death, you know, then they're buried. And it seems to me there's something a little bit more sensible and reasonable about that than the customs which we've developed in our own country.
Right, and I would say yes. I would say if that were the decision of you guys as a group of pastors to move with that kind of a cultural interpretation, I'd say probably in your place, great. But at the same time, be ready to realize that in your post-death ministry to the bereaved, things might open up that didn't open up because it was compressed. You know what I mean? That's the only thing I'm saying. Where you take from one side, be ready to give on the other. And when you take from that side, be ready to give to the other.
It's a matter of proportion.
You made a statement at the beginning about how you were involved, I think, in the death of your father or someone.
In your family.
I was a boy down in Perry County, and I was a PK. And they had a custom there that I always thought was a good one. I've been trying to figure out a way of bringing it into my congregation. These people did not have funeral homes. You know, the body was at home, like you said, and people came to the homes to visit. There wasn't this big wake deal, you know, where often things go on that really do hurt the family more than they become family reunions, you know. But they had the custom of taking the body to the cemetery from the home, and everybody knew about that because the bells were ringing, and this was in horse and buggy days, and they took a long time to get from a farm to the funeral, to the cemetery, and everybody in the family also took part in throwing a lump of dirt onto the pine box or into the grave. And maybe some of those things were kind of morbid. I know that most of us had to attend. The school was in session often, and the parochial school would dismiss so we could all go to the funeral, to the cemetery. And maybe the children had to sing or something. And that the one thing that always bugged me about that was that I didn't like that rumbling of the clods of dirt hitting the box. So as soon as this was over and when that started, I took off and beat it for church, you know. But the real thing about it was that they were then in church. They had buried the body, and they were then immediately after this in church, you know, and there a service of thanksgiving or memorial where the people became involved in what really had taken place and how this person now has gained the final victory. It's a little difficult to do that today because you can't get the people into the church because this happens during the day. And if you have it in the evening, I recently officiated a Negro funeral where we did have the service in the evening. The body was there, though, and then the next morning we took the body out and buried it. Now, maybe that has some things that could be done for us today. We'd get more people to come to church in the evening. But it's the involvement of the congregation. People can die, and unless you have a phone committee and so forth and call attention to people in a busy suburban community, the people are sort of surprised on Sunday morning when you have the prayer you know, of someone having died. Oh, I didn't know that, you know. This is what bugs me, that you can't keep the congregation involved, that a member, they are hurt or whatever it is because someone did die, you know, and you can't
right.
involve them. I'd like to ask one other question or two. You said something about, at the end a while ago, about in the questioning, I guess, you had a congregation where you had the permission to do all kinds of things, you know, as far as going to all funeral homes and serving. And I'm assuming that you're saying that you did bury those people. You also said when the question asked this, you didn't really want to get involved, and yet you said this, see. Now, I'm wondering what you did, you know, in cases of burying some of these people whom you didn't know, of whom maybe you, all the information you could find out is that they were not Christians, then what did you say in connection with the actual burial of that person concerning the resurrection and so on?
Yeah. When you go to another congregation and preach, you don't know the people there from Adam. You know what I mean? And so what happens is...
That's not the point. The point is, if you officiated someone's burial in the Christian way that we normally do this with our own people,
right.
Now you can assume, well, these people were Christians. I didn't know this black person either, you know, that I was talking about, but they were Christian people. But I'm thinking about, if in the case of someone where you really know that this person was not a Christian, all the evidence is that he was not. Now, if you were officiating at those funerals, that's what you were implying a while ago. Maybe you weren't, but if you were, then what did you say as far as that person is concerned in the resurrection unto life?
I can simply make a comparison, and what I make a comparison of the life without God over and against the life that is lived with God. It's very parallel and similar to a situation, as I was going to say, where you go to a congregation that you never knew and do not know and preach a sermon. What you do there is you make a detached proclamation of the Christian faith under the terms of some topic, dynamic, or and text. In your own congregation, you make an in-depth proclamation of the Christian faith through what you know to be the dynamics of the lives of that in that congregation. In the same way, when you hit a funeral where the person who has died is not a Christian, you proclaim to the non-Christian audience there what your faith is all about, and you tell the truth, and you try to persuade people to begin life as Christians. And the dead man, of course, is your biggest visual aid.
Would this change the subject too much to ask whether you and Ed would talk a little bit? Death is Ed Schrader's enemy, and death is Bob Werbrig's friend. Could you introduce him to one another?
All right. Mind if I lead off, Ed? Let me just say why I said that. My understanding of the perhaps not specific development of the theme of death within the New Testament, but on the basis of a systematic and perhaps a doctrinal appraisal of the content of New Testament teaching about death, is that death, along with all the other enemies of the Christian, has been conquered in the death and resurrection of Jesus Christ. To talk about that abstractly involves the business of, let me put it this way. Because of the fact that a Christian is baptized into Jesus Christ and baptized specifically into the death of Jesus Christ, he is involved in the supreme death of all deaths, in the comprehensive and ultimate death that any man, including the man, Jesus Christ, the God-man, can suffer. It is therefore, for the Christian, and from the Christian point of view, an historical experience. It's historyless people, who have trouble dying. And our history is rooted in the death of Jesus Christ as a gone experience, as an experience that has happened, right? And therefore, my view of death would say that to say death and to mean death as enemy is no longer good language for a Christian, because the death of Jesus Christ has transformed death to the point where it is passage, or where it is door, or where it is entrance. So you almost can never use that word in your vocabulary anymore, since it's conquered and overcome, and it has been converted, so to speak, to a good use for the Christian. And I have diagrammatic ways of saying this that are much better than my words, but it would take another 5 minutes.
Oh, go ahead.
Yesterday I used the Luther analogy of a serpent with its fangs broken out, that death for the man who is in Christ is still a pretty grisly critter, but the sting, the real ultimate deadly quality about death, that God himself is saying, I don't like you, get out of my creation, which is what God regularly says to uncovered sinners, sinners who aren't covered with Christ. I would prefer that kind of language rather than the word friend, which seems to me to be, in our normal use of the word friend, just too chummy. An enemy who is conquered doesn't, by that fact, suddenly become my friend, at least if he really, and this isn't a pun, was my mortal enemy. If he merely willed my destruction, then I can't say, well, hooray, I like you after all. I'm not sure whether in our Christian rhetoric, especially in our hymnody and liturgy, that word ever does get used of death. You know, George? Death as friend? I don't. It may be. I'm quite a bit of very ignorant on this area. Things like the psalmist, Psalm 23, yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil. He doesn't say, I will fear no evil, because now the valley of the shadow of death is kind of friendly. But he at least, I'm interpreting, he says, it's still the valley of the shadow of death, but the reason I don't fear evil is in the sense that you, my friend, you, God, are my friend. Your rod, your staff, your resources comfort me. And my guess is that the New Testament, when it puts Jesus into the equation, into the mix, as it does, to make the new thing about the Christian's view toward death, would be more inclined to say, I walk into the valley of the shadow with my final wrestling with this enemy, with Jesus as my friend. And because he keeps friendly relations with me, continues to call me brother, and thereby call me God's son, as he is son number one, and I'm sort of second, third, fourth, 50th generation sons, that's where I would find it easier to talk about friendliness. Now, the place where I have said nothing, especially yesterday, and many of you, or several of you at least, were raising that point, was in early Christian apostolic language that sort of welcomes death. And somebody even quoted the old Cum Zeuser Tot at me the other day, yesterday afternoon. The Zeusness, the sweetness of death, is not that that black beast suddenly gets sugar-coated. If there's anything welcome about death, it's only welcome by virtue of what's at the upper half of the banner and what he has done, our Lord, which doesn't yet sugarcoat death. but gives me an alternate resource whom I hang on to and who hangs on to me as I march into my own particular valley of the shadow of that enemy. The places where I do hear the New Testament almost welcoming it, that is, to be sure, based on that kind of foundation. And I hear Paul welcoming it on occasion in some of his personal biographical statements in the his epistles, and occasionally in some of his paranesis, his pastoral counseling talk to his congregations, is welcoming it the way the man in Christ welcomes the finishing off of the death of his own sinnerhood, his own old Adam. But my old Adam, per se, can no way welcome its own extermination, because that old Adam is me. And the only I that can say yes to death and finally even welcome it with some kind of open arms, and maybe even then say Zeuser tot, I still wouldn't say Freund tot, would be that self who stands en Christo, which in effect is that self who is hanging on to Jesus.
I would like to speak in response to the one man's statement about a sudden or quick burial or removal of body after it died. I felt this way until I heard a child pastor speak on this subject. And he said that the main problem that he encounters with children through the death and grief process is this thing of denial. And unless we allow children, and he says this goes for adults too, to actually see the dead body, it takes so much longer for them to work through this denial process. And he said a good rule of thumb was that children especially should see the body at least twice. Once before they slept, and at least once after they had a chance to sleep. And I really hadn't thought about, you know, the need for this physical evidence of death. He said so often when a father or a grandparent or someone dies, we send the kids across the street to stay with the neighbors until the funeral has been prepared, and then we ask them if they want to go to the funeral. No, they'd rather stay and play with Johnny. And then we go back and get them after the funeral and bring them home, and that person's gone. And they don't have the foggiest reason why, because they didn't go through the process of, well, getting rid of it. And,
Or they have guilt because of the fact that they're being pulled out of the room where the dying happened is somehow associated with their own sense of responsibility and accountability.
But he, you know, really emphasized this need at least for a day or two for people to see, and he said this wasn't just true for children, but adults too. And especially spouses, you know, to actually see that that person is dead. And if it's removed right after they die and they never see him again, the denial process takes a lot longer.
Right. Well, I think here again, you have to recognize the built-in ambiguities that are characteristic of anything that goes on under heaven. Your principle, enunciated by the psychiatrist, the principle cannot be applied to all situations evenly and flatly, nor can you expect that children are going to respond in the same ways to death situations. First of all, young children cannot be expected to accept death as final. Young children perceive death as a going away, going on a journey, a departure, and so forth. A good system of insights can be afforded by the reading of the James Agee story, A Death in a Family. But I should like simply to underline the fact that there are certain very identifiable responses that children of different ages have over and against the occurrence of death in their families, let's say. And all of these have to be taken into consideration in how you handle them.
Consequently, as Benson mentioned yesterday, there is not only a need for moving in and doing the best thing that you feel is the best thing to do, sort of, in a way, like, but to have specific knowledge about these problems is important.
Mr. Gunther, just a minute. I'd like to comment on this particular question in a little broader scope. Psychologically, I think we should be aware of loss in general in life in a different way than we probably have in the past. Not only is this very important that this child, for example, has the opportunity of seeing the one who has passed away and not being deceived by the parents by a sort of process of protection, but any loss in your life must be dealt with in the same way. Any loss, maybe the loss of changing from one parish to another where you're losing a whole group of people you've loved, you've been close to, you've shared life with. Unless you've brought that out in the open and you have actually verbalized this and talked this over with spouse, particularly with those people, very openly and very frankly, if you quietly sneak away, don't say anything about it, close your eyes to the fact of loss of what you have there, you'll carry with you something that will constantly work, be working inside of you. There's a direct correlation with this in the life of people that are afraid to work with a mourning process. That's why so much today is made of grief, not only in connection with death, but the whole grief process is constantly taking place in our life. George yesterday referred to our constant dying, and I know what he's referring to, not only to the death that we were particularly concentrating upon yesterday, but the constant need in our life to be aware that in the growth process we have to give something up to which we have been clinging desperately. Speaking here of defense mechanisms and everything else, we suddenly have recognized we're using. When we give this up, we don't do it without a genuine struggle. A struggle that has to be verbalized, brought out into the open, spoken to, and admittedly said by the individual as a thing that he recognizes he is now deliberately and willfully given up. It's not done without an individual feeling a hurt. When you're working, for example, with people in your parish who love you, and yet you're trying to help them, often you will wonder why at certain points there may be genuine exhibits of anger. Be aware that that's a fact where you are asking them, for the sake of their love for the Savior, to give something up within their life which is painful to do. And the Spirit will have to give them a special measure of power to do so. So I want to emphasize that, because this psychologically is something we often don't think about and don't deal with and understand the dynamic that's involved. Mr. Governor?
I would like to make a point in regard to who deserves a Christian burial. In my 50 years, I've refused only one funeral, and that is the case of an infidel whom I knew was a pronounced unbeliever, had no use for Christ. I had waited on his wife. He's a professed Lutheran, had her funeral. When the sons and daughters came to have a funeral for their father, I says, "Your father is an infidel. He has no use for Christ. If I go through a Christian burial ceremony, as you expect, then that would be a very decided contradiction to your father's life. Do you wish to have that kind of a funeral?" They said, "Well, we excuse you. We will not ask it."
Further questions? Yes, sir.
I very much appreciate what you just said. I think we have to bear in mind that when we deal with a bereaved family, that we have to realize they are really going through pain over the loss of a loved one. We can talk all we want to about the joy that should be in their heart over the triumph of their loved one over death through Christ. And we can talk to them about the great joy that belongs to their loved one in heaven. But we must never forget that that family is going through a great heartache over the loss of a loved one. And we need to help those people turn to God for help and comfort. We need to assure them of God's promises of companionship and strength and support, so that they will have the conviction in their heart that He's going to help them through losing this loved one, see? So that's why I don't think we can just be talking about the great joy and support and triumph that belongs to the one who died. We've got to deal with the actual heartache of the family that lost the loved one.
Carl?
This speaker before, Professor Falkenroth, I think referred to an earlier question, which I don't think Professor Werberg has yet answered. In his ministry dealing with people who were known to be non-Christians. I feel there's a vast difference between dealing with that kind of a situation and going to another congregation where you assume, hopefully, that the people are Christian. When I, as a new pastor, come into a new congregation, I don't know them in any depth, but I preach to them as Christian people. If I go as a visiting pastor to a neighboring congregation only one Sunday, I preach to them as Christian people. You say when you have served at a funeral for a non-Christian, you tell the truth, and that I appreciate. But you have not answered, what do you do in the cemetery? You obviously could not have, I don't think in good conscience, a Christian committal, and I think the brethren are waiting for some kind of words, what you would say, you know, because you can't say in view of the hope of the resurrection. Could you answer that?
All right, I can't really at this moment give you the exact words, but I developed a form of committal, a burial situation for use in those instances, which again was simply a restatement of the creedal facts about the Christian faith, you know, and was designed to be heard by those who are alive and not intended to be understood by them as a testimony to the belief of the dead man. Now, I might be able to send you that if you want, if I can dig that out.
I might help here. I was a chaplain in the Army, and we had a committal service in which the words, the hope of the resurrection to eternal life, were not used. I was interested very much in your comment that you put yourself first on the list with all the mortuaries. I'm a member of the Veterans of Foreign Wars, and as such was their chaplain, and I became a regular burying Sam. And it started to bother me because I had contact with all these people, most of them unchristian people, some actually infidels, that is the living families. And I think the straw that broke the camel's back, maybe I'm guilty of burying my head in the sand, was when an old cavalry sergeant was buried, and we had arranged the service, but you know, at the last minute there was a change, and the music was, I'm heading for the last roundup and empty saddles in the old corral.
This is what I meant. This is what I meant before when I said I would rather sin in the area of too much than too little. If, for instance, it turned out that either my commitment or circumstances beyond my control forced me into a position where I was unable to make any kind of follow-up ministry to the bereaved under that kind of a policy of getting on every guy's list, then I would think twice about it too. But under normal situations in a parish, that became the center and the heart of my evangelistic work.